It feels a great honor, a great privilege to practice the Dharma with you all these last few days. The new, very new context for us to be in, being here in Israel, and so it's stimulating in different ways. It's also the same wherever one meets human beings. We have the similar concerns, challenges. There's also unique different qualities that resonate, and so it felt very. The response for us has been very inquiry, the sincerity, the dedication, the application that everyone has put into the retreat, those supporting it, those participating. It's felt very good. It brings up a lot of whole appreciation and heartfulness. When I first heard Ajahn Chah, when I first met Ajahn Chah in 1977 in England, outside of Oxford, where he came to give a Dharma talk to some students, and I had been on a retreat, a Ubakin retreat, and skipped out of the retreat to go and hear, which wasn't particularly allowed, but anyhow, to go and hear Ajahn Chah, this great teacher. And it was the first time I'd really heard a very, you know, live Dharma talk from someone that was considerably, Ajahn Chah said, it takes one to know one. I think he was awakened, but I wouldn't know. But he had a tremendous impact. And although he was speaking Thai and it was translated all the way through his talk, I kept thinking to myself, this is so good, this is so wonderful, this is so fantastic. And then at the end of the talk he said, if you've been sitting here listening, this is good or bad, then you haven't been listening properly. Oh, gee, that's good. So, learning to listen beyond our assumptions and views and fixed conclusions about ourselves, about life, is an aspect of the artfulness of meditation. And learning to listen inwardly to our own being. A lot of meditation is really developing this capacity to listen more kindly, more patiently, inwardly to our own being. We have so many harsh projections and demands upon ourselves about how we should be and how we think enlightenment should appear to us. Quickly, preferably, mostly, from what I've been hearing from everyone and from what I hear from myself. We're very, very impatient with the actual process of being human. You know, all the foibles and worries and doubts and that we all share. Lack of confidence or insecurities or confusions. And this tendency to be very impatient with all of that and want to push through it and to sort of have an antiseptic sense of ourselves almost, where there's no worry or no doubt. There's a sort of an internal model sometimes that the perfect way to be is, you know, continually clear and continually unobstructed, which is unrealistic. And so inevitably when we come to sit in stillness, we're going to be with a lot of listening to and need to be with many different aspects of our being. It's not necessarily going to come under control by an act of will or demand. A lot of what we listen to in the Buddhist word is sankhara, these patterns, these habits, these conditionings, these imprints that flow, that have momentum, that have a certain power, that have a certain influence, a certain energetic effect, a certain feeling of tone. And this sankharic material, these senses of ourself, are very, sometimes very strong. And it takes a lot of patience just to listen and to get more familiar with those patterns, tendencies towards feeling. With my own tendencies, I've noticed over the years the different layerings of sankharic material. Sometimes you can begin to discern particular tendencies of the mind, of the heart, a certain feeling tone that appears around one's sense of self. And I notice as one layer goes beyond sometimes the layer of the storyline, the movement of the mind, one can get down to some pretty basic, shared, I think, energies, ones of fear or ones of lack of sense of worth or ones of doubt or ones of resistance, aversion, that color and flavor and get projected onto the sense of self and the sense of the world around, and we don't even know it's happening. So some of these sankharas, the Buddha said, are like lines drawn in sand. They're very light, maybe. Just we're sitting here, there's some awareness, some mindfulness, and an imprint of some irritation emerges, someone moves in the way that we don't like, a bit irritating, and we see it, and it dissolves. It's not very strong. Some of them are like lines drawn in sand. We might see it. And it has a bit more momentum. We see it and it starts to flower into a bit more aversion, and then maybe it hooks into a memory pattern, and then we get lost in some old storyline. There's more energy there. And then we see it, we sit through it, by the end of the sitting it's somehow gone, no big deal, move on. But some of these, the Buddha said, are like lines drawn in stone. They have a lot of energy. We've over unconsciously through our lifetime we've put in, maybe patterned in also from genetically, maybe from other lives, who knows whether that's the case or not, but imprinted very deeply physiologically. Some of these are energetic patterns, tendencies that have a lot of power. We've invested in them unconsciously through a lifetime, patterns of fear, patterns of aversion, of dislocation, disassociation, never quite being here. And as we start to listen in more, they become more conscious. And some of these we'll see them a million times, and they will still have some energy. They will still have some momentum. It's not necessary. I remember when I used to go and listen to Krishnamurti when he came to Brockwood Park, which was a community he had, still exists as a school near to where I lived in the south of England. And he used to say, if you've seen it once, it's gone. It's enough. In the seeing, it's finished. Well, quite frankly, that's maybe true for Krishnamurti, but it hasn't been true for me. Some stuff is just, it becomes like a bit of an old, an old friend almost, an old grumpy friend coming again in the morning to greet me. Hello, how are you? Grump, grump, grump. Okay. And so some of these we learn to create perhaps a different relationship with. And the relationship is one that allows doesn't necessarily even demand that it totally dissolves and goes, but it allows some freedom through the knowing, through the seeing. There's a lovely image I like very much from the Buddha's enlightenment, when he's sitting under the Bodhi tree, the night of his enlightenment, and all sorts of forces are arrayed in front of him. Forces of seduction, beautiful maidens, the memory of his home, longing to go home, the aggression, huge elephants coming to charge, all the sort of mythological imagery that creates this sense of how the mind is with all these different forces to try and knock him off balance, to try and diminish his enlightenment, to try and create doubt. And it's called the whole array of Mara pulled out every trick in the book to try and diminish the Buddha. And the Buddha just sat there unmoving under the tree and just said, "I know you, Mara." It wasn't like you get out the AK-47 and blast Mara off the planet. It wasn't like run and try and hide. It's a force, force of delusion. It's something that we always have. The Buddha was always, even after his enlightenment, he was followed, it said in the suttas, for 7 years by Mara, whispering in his ear, "You know, you're not really enlightened." It's the doubt, the doubting mind. You know, you haven't really got it, Buddha. Not that cracked up to who you think you are. And this, just this refrain, in a way, Mara became, and the Buddha became quite, I wouldn't say almost friendly, but they certainly had, there was a dynamic there. Those forces quickened the awakening, the awakened mind, just knowing this is how it is. I know you, Mara. And so sometimes when these sankharic patterns, feelings of heaviness, we don't even know quite what it is. It just descends on us. Feeling of depression, which feels very ancient. Some of them feel very ancient. Fear. I notice that in the process of letting go, these more subtle forces come up. I notice for myself, there's a lot around just the nameless fear. One won't be enough. I don't quite even know exactly what it is. Can't exactly package it, but it feels very good just to know it, to have moments of just knowing it's like this, I know you, which at that point it becomes a contemplation. One of the beautiful teachings that the Buddha gave for overcoming these sankharas, these obstructions, for being with them with a skillful attitude, I think, because I think attitude is very important in this meditative work, was a teaching he gave called the Awada Padimokkha. It was the original Padimokkha means path of liberation. It also means breaking up the causes for rebirth. It's the discipline, it's the observances of the monastics. And the observances really only arose as things started to go wrong in the order and people would do things that were inappropriate, and so the Buddha had to make an observance and then another one and another one until they wound up with hundreds of observances to just try and keep the order harmonious. Some of the observances were moral, ethical. Some of them were about the relationship to requisites to keep the simplicity of the life. Some of them were about relationship to other order members or to the lay people, to the material realm. But in essence, his first teaching he gave to enlightened disciples, actually, it was a gathering. It's remembered every year in Theravada countries as the Magga Puja, the puja, the observance of the full moon of February. And every full moon of February, this teaching of the Awada Padimokkha is celebrated. And the original story was that spontaneously 1,200 arhats gathered together. Arhats are enlightened beings, his disciples, the most mature spiritually, gathered together spontaneously. They didn't need an email, they didn't need an invitation or fax. They just knew that they should come and be there to hear the Buddha's teaching. And he gave this teaching, and you would think, well, what would a Buddha say to 1,200 already awakened beings? Surely it must be a very esoteric teaching, very subtle. But in fact, the first line that he came out with was patience. Patient endurance is the highest practice for overcoming unwholesome tendencies. Well, the word overcoming tapas means to burn away. Nibbana is the highest goal, so say the Buddhas. And there's a few more verses, but for this evening, so-called this evening, this simple practice that was recommended, even to those that are already awakened, that there's an attitude in the meditation that needs to be there, which is one of whatever we're with. Even the Buddha awakened, having to deal with so many problems and conflicts in the world, they didn't all go away. It wasn't like sometimes this idea of enlightenment or nirvana is there's no more problems, no more conflict. It's very naive. In some ways, it's more and more challenging. So this notion of the patience to allow these obstructions, these sankharas, to little by little applying moments of mindfulness to burn away. They may still appear, but less and less they have power over us, less and less they dominate us, less and less they shape us. They're just there, they appear, they get less powerful. This process of purification, there's a lot of language, a lot of the language as we've been talking about, as we've been practicing, is this notion of letting go, non-attachment, as a way, as a means to bring us to an inner dimension, or a dimension of our being that's more unmoving, more bright, more still. And then sometimes we think, well, what does that mean in relationships? How do we respond in relationships? A very necessary part of spiritual life is to really enter this process of exploring what it is to die to ourselves almost, or to let go of what we think we are. This willingness to have this inner attitude of relinquishment or letting go, to arrive fresh in each moment. The Buddha put it like this very beautifully in one of his conversations. To dry up the remains of your past, have nothing for your future, and even not to cling to the present, then you can go from place to place in peace. So this notion of not even clinging to the present, or this non-clinging mind that we've been exploring, very essential, but sometimes in the dying away can feel what's actually dying away is the false assumptions we've had about ourselves, or the views, or the ways that we think about ourselves, or the feverish momentum of the mind moving out into the next thing. When we don't move on that, when we allow ourselves just to stay still, sometimes it can feel like a death. Desire comes up. I want to go home. I'm never quite sure where my home is anymore, but I still have that feeling. I get very confused. I want to go home. Hang on. Which country, which place, which. But however, that and then just hearing a voice like that and not moving on it, it can feel like if you don't follow it, there can be the sense of dying or something just a loss. And so to tolerate in the spiritual language, there's a lot of talking about tolerating the dying away. Dying away to allow us to arrive into that which is peaceful in each moment. Sometimes this can sound like if we let go, we're just going to arrive at becoming an enlightened stone or an enlightened cucumber. You know, it's just totally incapable of response. We're just, nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to grasp onto, nothing to become. What does that mean? Does that mean that we don't act? Does it mean that we don't respond? Or I think it's helpful in this language of Buddhism, other spiritual languages, to look at the way that it's talked about as two levels of reality, two dimensions of reality. I think when we get a feeling for that, then we can begin to know how to put things in perspective. The one level that the Buddha called the unconditioned, or as we've been mentioning, he called it the deathless, the timeless, the immeasurable, the transcendent, these kinds of words, the immanence, here and now. It's a dimension also, we could say that's a dimension of our being, actually. And in meditation we're aiming to realize that more, to rest in that more. But it doesn't deny the relative realm of reality, the conditioned, the relativity, that there is manifestation, that there is name, that there is personality, that there is form, that there is time, that there is relationship, that there is action, there is result. And that's another dimension of our being. And they're both needing to be attended to. One very nice, in looking at this, or contemplating this, the transcendent dimension, there's a beautiful quote from a great saint called Anandamayima, who is a contemporary saint of India, one of these beings that sort of arrives on the planet already radiant and ecstatic and realized and somehow never forgot their true nature. And she was asked once, "Who are you? Who are you, Anandamayima?" And her response was, "There's nothing much to say. Before I was born, I was the same. As I grew up, I was the same. When this body was married, I was the same. In going about my daily chores, I am the same. And in death, I will be the same. Even as the dance of creation moves through the halls of eternity, I shall be the same." What we are. It's an Anandamayima, but it's also what we are when we realize that transcendent dimension of our being, unchanging, unmoving. Another great spiritual luminary, Tibetan Lama, the Karmapa, when he was dying and he was laying in his bed and his disciples were around and they were grieving upset, crying. He sat up and he said, "Don't worry, nothing's happening." It's that dimension. It's that. Or in more simple terms, everyday terms, there's a wonderful poem from Layman Pang, 700, from 740 to 808, which is his lifespan. He said, "My daily affairs are quite ordinary, but I'm in total harmony with them. I don't hold on to anything, and I don't reject anything. Nowhere an obstacle or conflict. Who cares about wealth and honor? Even the poorest thing shines. My miraculous power and spiritual activity, drawing water and carrying wood." So this transcendent aspect doesn't deny activity. It doesn't diminish our ability to respond. In many ways, it helps illuminate how we can perhaps respond more skillfully in the world around us. If we only involved in the world of the relative realm, the world of response, the world of trying to get things right, the world of fixing everything, then there's no end to it. It never ends. This is the nature of samsara. We can never get it perfect. We can't get the perfect relationship, or the perfect family situation, or the perfect nation, or the perfect community, or the perfect work. It's the nature of things that they are as they are. And so if we don't have an enlightened perspective, then our activity tends to often become very misguided. We're trying to make things give us what they can't, make others give us what they can't. So there's the struggle, the endless struggle of it all. Or we're trying to find perfection and conclusion where we can't find it in the world of change. And so how can we, you know, respond? From the questions that have emerged today, written, there's a lot of questions about what should one be, what should one do, should I do this, should I do that? And in some ways, it's to honor the question. I think that for me, it's not always that the translation of the Dharma, the translation of the most subtle and deepest insights into activity feels like it's an ongoing exploration. I don't know if there's a right way. One should only be a monk, for example, or a nun, or one should only be a celibate, or one should... There's so many different ways to express our lives. And perhaps the optimum place that we can tune into what is our expression is from a place of emptying, from emptying the heart. And this is, the meditation that's not dependent on whether we're sitting or standing or in retreat or with spiritual friends. It's the meditation where we're continually, in every moment, developing this inner ability to empty, to meet freshly, and to allow, as we empty, then allowing the mindfulness, the awareness, to inform our response. The aware heart, in and of itself, has great capacity. Often we just have to feel into them, to get the sense of their qualities, great capacity for We have great capacity for delusion and hindrances that we've been observing, but we also have great capacity for wonderful qualities, for generosity, for sensitivity, for tenderness, for compassion when we meet suffering, kindliness. These are natural qualities. They can also be, as we look at tomorrow, they can be consciously cultivated and honed and tuned. The heart unobstructed in relationship is able to, when it meets situations of suffering within ourselves and in the world around, is able to feel compassion. Is able to not to, when the heart is more obstructed or more closed, when we touch the experience of suffering, we tend to go into denial or into judgment. We don't really want to feel the suffering. But when we're able to really, the awareness is more open, we're able to really resonate with the poignancy, the suffering of living beings, of ourselves, and to be able to respond, to know what are our skills, what ways we can respond. As recently, as you know, in South Africa, we have, there is a very large tsunami going through the country, which is the HIV/AIDS crisis pandemic, and which is affecting all aspects of society, family structures, people personally, individually, the economic welfare. And recently, Mr. Mandela's son died, and he died of AIDS. And he came out and spoke about it. There's also issues of denial and covering it up, and very, very complex issue there. And he came out public and talked about the need for there to be more awareness. And one of the things that he said is, if you can help, if you can do something, then do it. You know, if there's something we can do, then do it. And so I found that very, for me, it very much resonated, because this notion that somehow in enlightened activity that we should abdicate our ability to respond feels imbalanced. If we just want, if our trying to do something, it comes from a place of pity or a place of just trying to deny the suffering. Sometimes people can't tolerate suffering, just want to try and help to get rid of suffering. A place of response comes from compulsion. Then we might do some good things, but we're not really tuning in at a deeper level. So to feel it and to feel, how can we respond? How can we be with the situation? How can I use my skills? It can be in the realm of compassion. It can be just having ways of being more kind or more gentle with ourselves, with each other, more patient. Or noticing when we do flare up, when we get irritated or overwhelmed, to be able to reflect, what happened there? How can I adjust? How can I move the heart towards more inner non-aversion, non-hatred? So this is very challenging, easy in the world to actually meet situations that bring up a lot of aversion, a lot of division, a lot of hatred. And so it's a willingness to meet life, to feel conflict, to feel problems, to feel issues, but not without giving rise to hatred. It doesn't mean to say that we like what's going on, or we like what people are doing, or that we approve. But it means we can see it, we can resonate, we never lose the common human denominator that we share, which happens when we go up into the mind, and people become objects, it becomes them. And it's easy then to lose the sense of common humanity. And so these are deep questions that we can sometimes need to tolerate the lack of answer, or the lack of conclusion, to be able to live the question, as Rilke said in one of his poems, to live the question as an unopened package, as a room yet not entered. The question has energy in it, to run too prematurely to the solution, but to know that if there's doubt, if we don't know how to respond, then to come to the place of emptying, to come to the place of the moment, to wait, to listen, can sometimes allow the appropriate response. Maybe the response is action, creativity, using our gifts. Maybe the response is stillness, non-involvement, equanimity. Even if there's non-engagement, if there's awareness in the heart, if there's mindfulness, there's an effect. It's a bit like when we look at trees. We can look at the trees around us, the trees on the planet, and they're just doing their thing. They're a tree, and we can think they're not doing very much. They're not getting up, and they're not going and sorting out problems. They're not going and giving talks. They're not going and running retreats. What are they doing? They're useless. They're just there. But in fact, the tree is constantly taking in the poison, the carbon dioxide that we can't digest, and sending forth oxygen, oxygenating the planet, the lungs of the planet. It's a very silent process. And they're offering shade and beauty, nourishment to the earth. And as we know, as we're taking out the trees, more and more we're getting poisoned. And I like to think it's an analogy for a meditator. You can sit here and empty the heart, clear the heart, open the heart. And it can feel like maybe not much is happening. But even in that process, it's like as the sankharic material, as more and more we feel the poisons, we're in touch with them, we're not denying them, but then more and more as they touch the awakened heart, the heart of awareness, which is, we all have, we can all access, we can all reflect from. More and more as those poisons come and touch, and there's not the reactivity, there's not the grasping, there's not the becoming, then they get purified, they get dissolved, they get transformed, transmuted into oxygen, into life-giving energy. There's a beautiful poem to finish with that puts it like this. Pablo Neruda poem. It's called Keeping Quiet. Now we will count to 12, and we shall all keep still. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment, without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare wars, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it's about. I want no truck with death. If we were not so obsessed about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead, but later proves to be alive. Now, I'll count up to 12, and you can keep quiet, and I will go.